The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.
So comparatively, the U.S. has a strategy of resilience, that we build capability that we can actually not only defend, but they can survive conflict. You harden them, radiation harden, you build mega constellation structure. For China, it's more about compelling the U.S. basically to do something that they want you to do by showcasing capability, especially counter-space capability, right? They're doing that. For Russia, it's about ensuring that their space capability deters that particular nation from not escalating a conflict.
Aloha and welcome to Dialogue, where conversations shape security. I'm James Minnick, Colonel United States Army retired and professor here at the Daniel K. Inouye, Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. This is episode 58, Seizing the Orbital High Ground, a conversation with Dr. Namrata Goswami. For most of human history, geography shaped security. Mountains, rivers, oceans, and strategic choke points influenced where nations could project power, defend territory, and secure an advantage. Military leaders have always understood the value of high ground, the ability to see further, move faster, and act before an adversary can respond. Today, that search for advantage extends far beyond Earth. Space is no longer just a frontier for scientific discovery or commercial activity. It has become a critical arena of global security. Satellites guide military forces, secure communications, enable precision navigation, and provide the early warning systems that help prevent strategic surprise. Every day, activities in orbit influence decisions made on land, at sea, in the air, and in cyberspace. For decades, space was viewed as a supporting domain, vital, but largely operating in the background. That view is rapidly changing. As great power competition intensifies, space has become increasingly contested. Nations are investing in rapid launch capabilities, resilient satellite constellations, and counter-space systems designed to disrupt or degrade an adversary's ability to operate. Meanwhile, commercial mega-constellations are transforming access to orbit, creating new opportunities while introducing new vulnerabilities. In a recent chapter, Seizing the Orbital High Ground, published in America's Strategic Edge, Deterrence, Lethality, and Warrior Ethos in the Indo-Pacific, Dr. Goswami argues that what once served as a supporting function has become a contested warfighting domain, directly shaping conflicts on Earth. Her central insight is that control of the orbital high ground increasingly determines operational tempo and strategic advantage. For the Indo-Pacific, these developments are particularly significant. The region's vast distances, maritime geography, and dependence on long-range communications make space-enabled capabilities indispensable to both military operations and economic activity. This shift forces us to confront important questions. Does control of space confer a decisive strategic advantage? How vulnerable are modern societies to the disruption of space-based services? And as activity expands towards the moon and into cislunar space, how might competition reshape deterrence, escalation, and security itself? To help us navigate this new frontier, we're joined by one of the leading voices in space policy and strategy. Dr. Namrata Goswami is a professor of space security for the U.S. Space Force's Shriver and West Space Seminars at Johns Hopkins University. Her research examines great power competition in space, the strategic implications of emerging technologies, and the future of security beyond Earth orbit. Today, we'll discuss why space has become the orbital high ground, how competition in space is reshaping military strategy, and what it means for the future of the Indo-Pacific and the world. Dr. Namrata Goswami, welcome to Brunei. What an amazing opportunity to have you here.
Thank you, Dr. Minish. It's fantastic to be here.
Oh, wonderful. I'm going to call you Namrata throughout this. You call me James.
Okay,
so this week we had you here in our course ipsos me, as we refer to it, and you spoke about seizing the orbital high ground, a new book chapter that you wrote in our latest series that we're doing here, America's Strategic Edge. I want to pull a little bit on this. First of all, seizing the orbital high ground. That's a unique title. Tell me what you were thinking about when you think about seizing the orbital high ground.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I thought about this particular article that I wrote for your book, America's Strategic Edge, there were two things that actually determined the kind of title that I thought would be useful, as well as the topic. So when you think about seizing the orbital high ground, what I meant by that was from a military and national security perspective. So as we see, since the 1990s, space is starting to play a very critical role in terms of intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, over the horizon, precision navigation, guidance of missiles, as well as long-range bombing. So in some sense, that's what I meant when I used the term seizing the orbital high ground, is that that particular nation that is able to not just have those assets, but also has the ability to protect or to degrade that of the adversary, seizes the high ground because of the fact that in terms of military power projection, space is becoming vital. And then the second reason why I thought that is a very interesting title and kind of gives the message as well, that if you look at the military doctrines of several nations today, not just the United States with Space Force putting out doctrine on space, but China's military strategic guidelines, India starting to think about it as well. All of these nations that are very serious spacefaring nations are thinking about the critical importance of space, not just from civil, but military perspective. So, and they're thinking about how important it is from a strategic competition perspective.
Fascinating. So many things I want to pull on from what you just said. First thing, when I love the title, but I'll have to tell you, my mind goes back to a time long before space. And so I grew up actually being a fan of the American Civil War. Mm-hmm. And then on the 1st of July, 1863, General John Buford and the American cavalry was in Gettysburg, and he seized the high ground, and he said, "This is beautiful ground." And they said that they were able to, because of that, because they had a point of advantage, they were able to be victorious against the Confederates. How do you see being up in space, that orbital high ground, is an opportunity to have military advantage against, you'd already started sharing with China and Russia.
Yeah, so very similar to the area Gettysburg, as you're mentioning, in terms of where you are as a military, especially cavalry, right, or land forces. So very similar to that today, if you think about, especially for the United States, China, Russia, the very fact that they engage outside of their landmass, they have to project power, for example, across the Indo-Pacific. China, too. People think Taiwan is next door. It's not. China would require space support. So in some sense, that particular nation that can degrade an adversary's capability in space, that helps that particular nation to project power. What do I mean by that? I mean military power, naval forces, communication, for example, vital for military command and control. The nations I'm talking about are nuclear weapon states as well, so command and control from geosynchronous orbit. So think of a scenario where if there is a crisis, say in the Taiwan Strait, and say China degrades that particular capability, it could be reversible, cyber attacks, jamming, spoofing, or irreversible with like anti-satellite capability, right? The nation that succeeds in doing that absolutely seizes the advantage, like what you talked about in the Civil War, right, in terms of seizing the strategic high ground. So I think that you see in the games or the scenarios that are being played out. For example, China just did a very interesting live wire exercise in Tibet, and then they showcased a very similar capacity in Taiwan, where they integrated their anti-satellite weapons into their projection of power into the Taiwan Strait. So
you mentioned, you know, this first mover advantage type of thing, and you brought up about the Taiwan Strait. So what are states grappling with when they think about engaging or attacking in space, and maybe you might even pull on, I heard you use an example earlier today about Russia in February of 2022, yeah. Mm-hmm. And how they, some of their first attacks were against space assets, but not in the space, but actually on the ground. Yeah. Say more about that.
Yeah, sure. So when you think about what happened in 2022 with Russia, so if you look at, and again, that's why I really take your audience back to the concept of military doctrine. So if you look at China's 2015 strategic military guideline, the first time the Chinese People's Liberation Army basically projected to the world that space is a strategic high ground and is a part of strategic competition. So I'll get to Russia very soon. What they meant by that is that if we are in competition with the U.S. and if there is a crisis, because the United States military depends on space for almost everything, projection of power, moving forces, that is where we target. Now, that played out in Ukraine. So when Russia has been contemplating and gaming the Ukrainian scenario for several years, this is not something new, right? They went into Crimea, they went into Georgia, and now, of course, into Ukraine. So the first thing the Russian military did was target Viasat, which is the American company that provided command control capability to Ukrainian military. So why did they target that? So they targeted the modems that enable that kind of communication because they understood that if you're going to cut off communication, which is the first act of war at that time, which is a space act of war, which included a space capability, Ukraine will be without that kind of communication. There would be a blackout, and then Russian forces will come in. They will seize the orbital strategic high ground. Now, one thing that most people think when they think about space, they immediately go to low Earth orbit or satellites, right? But satellites are supporting modems on the ground as well. And that was the Russian, they've attacked the ground base capability.
So you just spoke about low Earth orbit and I guess there's LEO, MEO, and GEO, right? Mm-hmm. Explain the difference. Satellites are in each one of those orbits, right?
Yeah,
so, but they're different. And why? How so?
Yeah, sure. So when I'm talking about low Earth orbit, I'm talking about 100 kilometers to about 20,000 kilometers. That's low Earth orbit. Now, in low Earth orbit, you have satellites that they move around the Earth about 90 minutes. So they continue a particular, very fast. And the other thing is that when you think about low Earth orbit, one thing what nations are doing today is to have, if you want to have a global picture, you would require large mega constellation structures. You cannot have just few satellites which can be destroyed. What you need is a whole range of, say, about 5,000 to 6,000 satellites.
Is that the Starlink approach?
That's the Starlink approach. And that's China's Goong satellite constellation approach, right? And so that's number one. Now, when you think about medium Earth orbit, that's about between, say, 20,000 to about 24,000. That's where you have your medium Earth orbit capability. And then you have geosynchronous capability that starts about 36,000 kilometers above Earth's surface. Now, GEO is very important because unlike LEO, in GEO, you can actually, because in GEO, what happens is that it's like a fixed position when Earth rotates. If you put a satellite in GEO, it rotates absolutely along with Earth's orbit.
Looks like it's not moving.
Absolutely. It looks like it's not moving. But if you want to really look into an adversary's, for example, nuclear capability or missile capability, GEO is vital, right? And so if you locate a satellite there, you can look in almost every single time what's happening there. But the important point is, and this is where China is going, is that that's not enough, though. You need to have a larger global picture of battlefield mapping. So you need to have an integration between low Earth orbit capability as well as geosynchronous capability. So you have to have all to have a better understanding of the globe and your power projection capability.
So as we think about this architecture of advantage that I'll call it, and satellites in the different altitudes of space, is there... how many, there's like 13 or 15 countries that actually have put satellites into space. Are they operating in all those areas, or is working in geo, is that something that is reserved only a few of the...
Very few.
Is that right?
Yeah. So if you think about satellites and where they are, the U.S. dominates, especially because of SpaceX. SpaceX is about, at this point of time, nearly 7,000 satellites, and that has really gone up exponentially in the last few years. You have India, which has a satellite constellation much smaller. China is the next competitor. So compared to the U.S., let's look at military. So if you think about military satellites, China has very similar to the U.S., about 250 today. And they have also decided to place it not just in low Earth orbit, but geosynchronous orbit as well. You have other nations that have put up sets. Russia. Russia has capability quite high, actually, continuing with the Soviet Union. Japan. Japan has its own global positioning system. Europe. Europe has its own capability with Galileo. But then if you think about singular nations, if you think about African nations, not that much capability. So it's actually very limited. And more importantly, for your question, low Earth orbit is the area that does not have very good international law. So the Outer Space Treaty of 1967 does not regulate low Earth orbit. The ITU, the International Telecommunication Union, regulates geosynchronous orbit and the slots it can have. But because, as you said, not all nations have the capability to put satellites there. So we have very few.
You know, you mentioned the 1967 treaty, space treaty. 10 years before that, it was only 70 years ago, is when Sputnik was successfully launched. And then, as I think of calculate time, it was only, I mean, 69, I watched the space moon, the moonwalk. And then, in what seems to be a fairly short period of time, yeah, I was in the military all through the 80s, and then in 91, you brought up that in the early 90s that things changed. And I think the way they changed, particularly for the Gulf War, was we went from a period of time where we did not use GPS, yeah, global positioning systems in the military, to being successful in that war because the U.S. military was able to do a couple of things. One, it was able to navigate through the desert with GPS because there were no maps that defined the terrain. And so it was like, we don't have to guard over here because nobody's coming over here. But that was not the case. Mm-hmm. And then the precision strike with the that the U.S. dominated with and then continued to dominate with over time. And that was all made possible because of this transition into the use of space in that period of time. Is that how you see it, or do you see it differently?
No, I actually don't. So it ties a little bit back to the Cold War, mm-hmm, right? So when you think about the Cold War, space was extremely important for intelligence, so surveillance because of nuclear weapons and the verification, the whole national technical means of verification, there's a concept. So both the Soviet Union and the U.S. agreed to have this verification, and space satellites played a vital role in that. I mean, you brought up Sputnik. When Sputnik was launched in 1957, the biggest concern of the U.S. was that this was an intercontinental ballistic missile, which means if you're able to put it in space, you can put nuclear weapons in space, and that can target U.S. homeland. And if you remember the historical depiction of that fear, right? And that's where the U.S. started building its own capability. So I'm bringing that up because this conversation about the importance of space for military has continued and is historical. You had the Star Wars concept, for example, like the Golden Dome we are talking today, a missile defense shield. Daniel O'Graham, an Army officer, he wrote a book called The High Frontier, a very interesting thinker who talked about the importance of how do you have deterrence by denial? And so to answer your question, that was very theoretical, but in 1991, what happened during the Gulf War was that for the first time, the world and China suddenly woke up to the fact that U.S. military has a decisive advantage in targeting, precise targeting, and intelligence and battlefield mapping because of satellites. And that was when China took a decision that, my God, all our concepts still today, our way of warfare is going to be challenged if we do not have our own capability as well. And so they decided to build their own global positioning system from then on.
And you said in 2015 they put out a doctrine on that. Wasn't that also the year that they formed their own Space Force?
Yes, yes.
Did that play a part, you think, in the U.S. Space Force being formed in, what was it?
2019.
Yeah.
Several years later.
It was. It feels as if, though, there became militarization, as space as a domain of military, military domain, and that happens in this period?
Very much. It continues. So the conversation around the establishment of the Space Force has happened since 2001.
Okay.
So it's a very old conversation. So many military thinkers, rightly so, I agree with them, argued that, well, if you really are talking about space as the orbital high ground, you do need a service within the United States that focuses on the domain. The Air Force, for all its wonderful culture, is a force that prioritizes fighter planes and fighter pilots, right? We do need space officers and operators that think of space for their own sake. So this conversation has been happening for some time, but I agree with you that when in 2015 China and especially President Xi Jinping, after conducting about 500 workshops, so if you remember at the time when he became president in 2013 and secretary of the Communist Party of China, he became that at the same time. So President Xi argued that, well, we really need to build our technological capability, and space was one of them. And so he conducted all this military reform, and that's where the PLA Strategic Support Force was established. And space was recognized as a high strategic high ground, orbital high ground. That kind of galvanized the U.S. Congress to then challenge the U.S. Air Force that how is it possible that we have an adversary that is showcasing such capability, and we feel like we are behind.
You mentioned just a moment ago you about the Golden Dome. Mm-hmm. So just this week while we were here, Secretary of War had announced a successful test of directed energy weapon system. Are you observing that? Did you track that at all? I guess what I'm asking is, since they had conducted the test and they've indicated an intent to have an operational system by 2030, I think is the year, it's a three phases, as I understand it, within the system with that includes ground-based interceptors, THAADs, and
space-based interceptors.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe you might describe a little bit about the Golden Dome.
Yeah. So the Golden Dome concept draws its origin, as I mentioned before, from the concept of Strategic Defense Initiative that
President Reagan's Star Wars.
So the concept is that if you are thinking about countering intercontinental ballistic missile and securing the U.S. homeland, you need to have the capacity to target it at its boost phase. Because by the time the ICBM, the intercontinental ballistic missile, gets to space and then releases its warheads and starts to descend into a particular area, you might get some of them, but not all, right? So the Golden Dome, the very vision of the Golden Dome, if you look at the memo that the president put out, which was the Iron Dome of America in January of 2025, and now it's the Golden Dome, there are three things. One, that you build a capability that is going to be able to counter ICBMs, right? But it's boost phase. So what you need to build is space-based interceptors that can look into an adversary homeland and are able to target the launch at the boost phase, because that's where the warheads have not separated. So you're able to kill the capability right there. So that's an envision that draws from Strategic Defense Initiative. The second thing is that you have to do it very fast, because it's about a time of 5 minutes. So it's pretty fast, I know. So you have to target it within 5 minutes. That's where space-based interceptors are vital, because they are looking down and they're able to locate and you're able to target it. And then the final thing is, the whole concept of the Golden Dome is that because you are targeting it at boost phase and not just terminal phase where it's already out, you're able to secure U.S. homeland from attacks that are devastating. So basically, it's a deterrence by denial. The idea, and where, let me go a little bit theoretical here. So the idea here is that if you build such a capacity and you can showcase it to, say, an adversary or a competitor, they would be hesitant to then launch such a capability. So you basically deter. And I think this draws on Daniel O'Graham and the amazing thinkers the U.S. had in the 1980s that argued that the very fact that the U.S. accepts mutually assured destruction is unacceptable. How can you tell your own people that, you know, you can, millions will die? We need to have a deterrence capability.
Pull just a little bit more on the Golden Dome. So we've had the ground-based interceptors that have been up in Alaska, and of course, I think if you probably saw the movie House of Dynamite,
yes.
And many of the viewers will have saw that, and that gives you a perspective of how these ground-based interceptors are intended to intercept incoming ICBMs. Mm-hmm. But that was predominantly, I think, targeting against North Korean capabilities that were... And those capabilities are getting so much larger than they once were. And so the need for a system which is more robust than the earlier system brings us to the rationale for the...
Yeah. The other point is hypersonics. We haven't got there, right?
So but go and explain that just a bit, and then...
So it's the speed of a Mach 5.
Yeah,
so it's very fast.
Five
times the speed of sound. So... And China has about 75 nuclear warheads that are now paired with hypersonics, which means they are leading the game. And if you look at the memo, it says that the Golden Dome capability should be built in such a way that it can counter hypersonics. It's theoretical.
Yeah.
It's a challenge because to build that, right? Because as you know, the inspiration comes from Israel's Iron Dome. But Israel's Iron Dome, 90% successful, but they're also deterring very short-range missiles, nothing like ICBMs or hypersonics, right? So the Golden Dome, to answer your question again, is a pairing between ground-based, which we have, but also space-based, which is the new thing. We don't have it yet. And that is where the Golden Dome also challenges, for example, some of the assumptions of the Outer Space Treaty, and I referred to that in my article, where I pointed out that the Outer Space Treaty does say that you cannot place weapons of mass destruction in space, which is a principle, U.S. is signatory, but it says nothing about conventional weapons, right? So if you have space-based interceptors, you are, in some sense, militarizing and weaponizing space. But then it also has such a deterrence effect. But you will have to have the whole system, ground-based and space-based pairing. It's very expensive. It's reaching about $1 trillion right now because of how much it'll cost. I know we have some companies that have been already directed to do this and have won contracts. It's in the initial phase today. And by 2030, we're hoping to have some capability. But China already has the hypersonic capability today.
North Korea is building hypers, hypersonic capabilities. You spoke a little bit ago about this escalation threshold and that not all actions in space are permanent. But maybe you might, pull a little bit more on that. I mean, it seems like it could be difficult for an opponent to understand your designs when you set off to either capture, destroy a satellite or something. And so what actually defines escalation as you see it?
In space,
yeah.
So let me get specific here, because sometimes when we think about it theoretically what it would mean is that, so you have reversible attacks. So reversible, if I am a satellite and you attack me, you're doing a cyber attack, or you are jamming some signals. So you're not really destroying the capability, you're destroying what it's offering, the effects of it, right? Okay. You're not enabling that. So you can jam from the ground, you can have ground-based jammers, you can do it from directed energy, for example. But in terms of response mechanisms, it is happening as we speak. But states decide that, okay, this is not destructive enough. My capability still exists. We're losing it for a very short time. But then, in 2007, China tested an anti-satellite weapon capability. And what they showcased, an ASAT. So what they showcased by destroying their own weather satellite, that they can destroy U.S. satellites. Now, that's escalation. It hasn't happened yet. A nation has not destroyed another nation's satellite. But the fact that there is signaling that itself is escalation, right, that we can do this. And then U.S., of course, did Operation Burnforced, where we showed our own capability, that we have the capability as well. India tested an anti-satellite weapon in 2019, and then Russia in 2021. So that's escalation. If you're targeting another nation and destroying their satellite, it could be seen as an act of war. And what is interesting is that during the Ukraine conflict, Roscosmos, which is Russia's space agency, gave several interesting insights. And one thing they pointed out is that if you target Russian satellite capability, we will treat it as an act of war, right? So, and that's why they showcased their own anti-satellite weapon capability in 2021.
Just before the
Ukraine invasion, to kind of limit attacks on the Russian homeland. You can support Ukraine, but there is an escalation point there. And then finally, the escalation ladder gets really serious. So if you target low Earth orbit capability, which help missile tracking, it's one thing. But then if you're targeting geosynchronous capability, which is the one that I talked about, where satellites are fixed that are used for nuclear command and control, national technical means of verification where the nuclear weapons are, and you're blinding that or destroying that, that's escalation. Because then if I'm country A that has nuclear weapons and you're country B that has nuclear weapons, and I destroy your capacity to see if I am launching so that you can have warning, you would assume that I might launch a nuclear weapon. And so that's escalation. So it's interesting that when you think about China, and in my fieldwork in China, the one thing that Chinese strategic thinkers pointed out is that they have a no first use policy when it comes to any such nuclear weapons, but also attacking nuclear-based infrastructure because of that concern of escalation. Now, Russia, which is fascinating, has this strategy that, well, we can use signaling. So if you remember, I think, was it 2 years ago, where U.S. intelligence pointed out that Russia is going to place a nuclear weapon in space for detonation purposes? So Russia has a very different strategy here because they're concerned about U.S. help to Ukraine. So they are showcasing to the U.S. that, well, because you have these mega constellation structures, we are going to use nuclear detonation in low Earth orbit that will destroy not one satellite, but several. So that could be escalation.
I want to come back to these competing strategies in just a minute and have you, talk out the China, Russia, and the United States strategy and how there's a difference. But you also spoke about the NC3, the Nuclear Command and Control Communications. The decade before the end of the Cold War, I was working in nuclear release authentication delivery. And so I have some experience from that period. But as I think about this, how is it that, are these lines, red lines that ought not be crossed, is the interfering with the early warning systems of nuclear delivery and stuff? And you were talking about adversaries, you know, potentially affecting this NC3, but say more.
Yeah, so I think we also have to make a difference between conventional and nuclear,
okay,
right? So I think it's good to give a specific case here. So think of a scenario if there is, say, escalation in the Taiwan Strait crisis, which happened in 1996, if you recall.
That's right, the 1996 crisis, yeah.
That was the big wake-up call for China. So what happened was that China had launched 3 missiles into the Taiwan Strait, and then they lost their eye on them midway, because at that time they were dependent on U.S. GPS. The allegation from the Chinese side is that the U.S. Air Force at that time had cut off the GPS link, right? So, and despite that, despite losing sight of their missile, which were conventional missiles, they did not escalate because they didn't see it as a threat to the Chinese homeland, right? Nor did the U.S. think that this was an escalatory scenario. But then that resulted in China then building their Beidou navigation system. Now, think about a situation if, by accident, either the U.S. or China had targeted a nuclear capability, because both nations are nuclear weapon states, both have missiles that can reach each other's homeland. Now, that could mean a very different scenario, right? That the fear that, well, if they're actually targeting our nuclear infrastructure, that means that this is going to go to the nuclear level, right? So in doctrine, and that is why doctrine really matters, many nuclear weapon states have no first use policy. India has no first use policy as well. I think the signaling is that, well, we would use conventional forces, as President Xi says, that I might use force as a last resort, right, for Taiwan. But when it comes to nuclear weapons, even a nation like Russia is careful. So
yeah, first use policy, the United States has a first use. North Korea has a preemptive use policy, Pakistan,
yeah.
That's right. And
yeah.
So You mentioned there's a difference, and rightly so, between disaggregated conventional and nuclear. Yeah. Let's do the same with military and commercial. Yeah. Yeah. And so when is attacking commercial satellites, is that provocative? Is that an act of war? How do you disaggregate that? What do you think?
Wow, that's a question that nations are grappling with, right? Yeah, because in the last few years, commercial has started to play a very critical role for military, including the U.S. Space Force and the U.S. Joint Force, right? So we depend on Starshield, for example, which is the defense version of Starlink, to enable communication. We are using a launch, for example. The United States is totally dependent on its commercial sector for launching its military assets today. SpaceX is the key.
No, it is. The days of NASA being ubiquitous in this space is...
It's the commercial sector. So now the million-dollar question for the U.S. is, and the Space Force is that, well, if a commercial company is in contract with you to support you, for example, in case of crisis or conflict, what happens if they are targeted? Because they're legitimate targets in war. Russia, by the way, and China, and I love this question because if you look at PLA Strategic Support Force doctrinal thinking, in 2015, 2016, they commissioned a study where they said that, well, the U.S. commercial sector is supporting U.S. military force projection, including naval deployment, deployment of special operation forces, targeting our, making battlefield targeting of based on ISR, we can target those commercial sector. They're part of the military industrial complex. Now, given that, the big question is if, say, a Starlink constellation is targeted, is it obligatory for the Department of War and the military to come to the rescue? I would say so, yes, but it's not written in statute. Whereas, now I'll tell you the most interesting thing happening in Europe. So I was recently in Europe in the Prague Space Security Conference, and German Space Command and Germany just put out its strategy for space. They call it the Safety and Space Security Strategy. If you read the document, it's absolutely game-changing. Mm-hmm. The German military now says that if you target German commercial sector in space, we will respond. So we will come to the rescue of the commercial sector, right? Which is something that is quite fascinating in the European context. India recently is arguing that, well, we are also building our commercial space sector for defense. So if you target our commercial sector, we might treat it as an act of war. But they have not, again, codified it into statute, right? So it's a great question to ask. I think we will, in the future, we will have to probably come to the rescue of especially those commercial companies that are participating in defense contracts with the Department of War.
Things are definitely heating up or changing or evolving into this area that you're speaking about. Let's go to the competing strategies now, and not just maybe give us an explanation of how these strategies, the Chinese, the Russians, the Americans, how those are different, but is one perhaps more effective than another in a crisis? How would you... So there's two questions there, define and then compare.
Yeah. Well, so if you look at the U.S. space strategy today, it's a lot about deterrence and ensuring that space assets can be used, especially in an environment where there is conflict. So access remains. The U.S. is very much focused on resilience, by which I mean hardening of your satellites. If you remember, General Hyten had said that if you have very few satellites, they are juicy targets, right? That's why we need to have proliferated constellation structures, where if you degrade a few, we still have access to several others. So it's a lot about resilience. It's a lot about tactical launch, for example. So you have very very quick reconstitution of satellite capability by building very specific custom-made rockets. Firefly is building it. With Victus Knox and others for the Space Force. So the strategy is about resilience, enabling the space capabilities to remain, especially in context of conflict. For Russia, which is very interesting, it's basically a strategy of using satellite capability for what they want to achieve, which is deterrence. So you deter by using our satellite capability, and that has actually worked, as you saw. When they did their anti-satellite weapon capability in 2021, the basic signaling to the United States was that you can, okay, you want to support Ukraine, but if you target Russian homeland, we will escalate and we will use our space capability to do so. And it's actually very interesting that even when the U.S. helped Ukraine with weaponry, there was a condition that you cannot use this against the Russian homeland. You can use it in the conflict in Ukraine when Russia is attacking you, right? For China, it's a very different strategy. So China's strategy is basically to use space capability for compellence. So what you're wanting to do is to showcase, say, anti-satellite weapon capability, your hypersonic capability, your launch capability, your doctrinal capability, to basically compel the United States to behave in the way that they want the U.S. to behave. So comparatively, the U.S. has a strategy of resilience, that we build capability that we can actually not only defend, but they can survive conflict. You harden them, radiation harden, you build mega constellation structure. For China, it's more about compelling the U.S. basically to do something that they want you to do by showcasing capability, especially counter-space capability, right? And they're doing that. For Russia, it's about ensuring that their space capability deters that particular nation from not escalating a conflict, because the one thing that Russia really worries about is regime change, right? So Putin really is concerned about that. Well, is it going to result in regime change, right? So
you said China compellence, Russia deterrence, United States resilience. Yeah. So in a crisis, which one is more effective? I don't know, maybe we're comparing apples and oranges, yeah. But you gave an example of Russia and how it was effective in its deterrence strategy. And clearly in deterrence, you need to have a capacity, credibility, and communicate it, yeah. Signal it. And they did this, and they assess, maybe we assess, that it was effective. So if we were had crisis other places on the globe, would these strategies be effective in keeping another country from taking action against them, in your estimation? Or is there one better, you know, maybe I'm just making things up.
No. I think it's a good question to ask, and it's something that we should think through if you're strategic thinkers, okay. Right? So, and are really care about the U.S. having the strategic advantage. It's important to understand where a nation that we're competing with is. So I think for the United States, I worry that institutionally we are not keeping up with China. And also in terms of capacity. Same. So, for example, hypersonics, right? Golden Dome is a reaction.
It is a reaction.
You already have the capability, and now you're talking about deterring a capability, which is very hard.
And if I were put words in your mouth, it probably costs more to try to defend against this than to create an offensive means. And so you're not only you're paying catch-up, you're constantly trying to, you're spending a lot more money to for what could be inexpensive capabilities to come in and attack you. But, I cut you off. Say more about...
Whose strategy is winning, right?
Yeah.
So now think about the South China Sea, right? So if you think about China's strategy, they not only use satellite imagery to lay claims, they also use satellite imagery to map. And then they use satellite imagery to project power, right? And how did they do that? They basically went ahead and build hardened capability there, including the ability to land military aircraft, radar installations, and then use their projection of power through space to basically compel the United States not to do what they didn't want the U.S. to do, which is to respond, to respond to a crisis in South China Sea. I mean, hardening of islands, right? In 2015, right after President Xi told President Barack Obama that he's not going to do that. So there is compellence right there. So
yeah, interesting. Maybe we'll take you to the place beyond Earth orbit, and you can talk a little bit about the cislunar space, and maybe why does it matter?
Yeah.
the space.
Yeah. So when you think about, I mean, the article was very much focused on military terrestrial capability, right? And I talked a little bit about cislunar space. So when we talk about cislunar space, James, we talk about, for your audience, the area of the 36,000 kilometers to about 240,000 kilometers. That is between geosynchronous orbit to the moon. So why is that space important? So two reasons. That's the real strategic high ground. So I have written a piece on that for Aerospace Corporation. So what happens is that if you have a capacity, say, in cislunar space, think of it as space situational awareness. Yes. You have intelligence capability or ISR, surveillance. With that capacity, you're not only looking at the moon, but you can look down. So you actually then can look at where your adversary's assets are. You can build that kind of capacity. Second, this is my biggest concern, is that when we think about the moon, if you're going to establish permanent capacity there, say, think about a base, and if China is building such a base, I mean, the argument they make at the United Nations, and by the way, they have a plan to build a base by 2036. The United States does too. It just announced through Artemis that they will build a moon base, right? But China's base is way larger in terms of thinking. They have been thinking about this since 2002. So it's a long-term thinking, right? So, but at the UN, what they argue is that, well, this is totally civilian. This is a China National Space Administration, so what we are going to build on the moon is going to be for everyone, right? But then when I dig deeper and I done research, so the China National Space Administration is run by the State Administration for Science, Technology, Industry for National Defense. And then the engineers and the recruits are mostly from the PLA, right? And so that's the concern. And so my concern is that, well, if they actually take over a most strategically important area of the moon, which is the South Pole, and establishes a base where the resources are.
Why is that the most strategic part of the moon?
Because that's where the resources are. So you have resources like helium-3 that can be used for nuclear fusion, which we are trying to get to. You have water ice that can be used for oxygen or for fuel for rockets. You have platinum group metals there. And actually, all this data, and this is where I think the U.S. had taken leadership once upon a time, all this data comes from the Clementine mission that happened in 1994, which, by the way, was part of the Strategic Defense Initiative testing of autonomous capability. It's a wonderful mission, and pretty inexpensive as well, about $75 million, right? And so, but we gave all that up, right, because we then stopped our lunar program. We didn't go forward with it. So my concern is that now they're using that similar data to build capacity and building their own data to take over areas in the moon that are very strategic, which will have implications, because I don't think the world has realized that till today we don't have a permanent base on another celestial body. We have the International Space Station, but that is in low Earth orbit, right? And so, yeah.
I want to ask you one more question. This one is going to bring it back into the Indo-Pacific, and we think about the fight. And so in a crisis, Indo-Pacific relies significantly on space-based command and control, right? And so in the first 72 hours, it seems like this may be a critical point on how we try to disrupt one side, both sides disrupting the other's space-based command and control. How do you think about that? And should there be reason to be concerned that they're vulnerable?
I think we have real good reasons to be concerned. So I just talked to you about the PLA Strategic Support Force, now the PLA Aerospace Force, focus on systems warfare. So what they argue is that, well, if you actually want to deter U.S. response, say, for example, we take over Taiwan in the Indo-Pacific scenario, right? And the one way that you can slow down or deter decision-making cycle is to target command and control and target space-based assets, which the U.S. depends on today, right? So in if you think about a 72-hour scenario, like Russia, that targeted Ukrainian military's modem capability, that probably pushed back Ukrainian response, and Russia was able to enter much more faster and then adapt as the war spread out. For China, I would see that as one of the first acts of the war. Target U.S. space-based capabilities, right, because of the fact that it's tied to. I don't think most people realize is that when China is thinking about targeting U.S. space-based capability, they're also connecting it to our own philosophy of joint warfare, right? So we talk a lot about how joint operations, how will the joint force move into the Indo-Pacific, right, in a situation of a crisis. So it could be several other things, but space also plays a very vital role. And in the first 72 hours, that's their doctrine. So I'm talking from their actual doctrine and strategic guidance that they want to target space.
Seizing the Orbital High Ground. It's online right now. Yeah. It will be in print early next month. I believe, and I know it's already receiving great interest, but this is a significant paper that talks about an issue of great concern, understanding space as a military domain, and you have done a masterful job in helping to elucidate that. I suspect many people are going to be reading that chapter of yours.
Well, thank you.
I know you're working on another book right now, and I often take this latter part of the segment of the of dialogue to be able to highlight a book. I want to highlight your book. Tell us about the book you're working on and what we what we'll find in that book.
Oh, what a wonderful opportunity! So, so the book that we wrote that got a lot of attention was called "Scramble for the Skies: The Great Power Competition to Control the Resources of Outer Space." My co-author was Peter Gerritsen, where we pointed out that nations are starting to think about space very seriously, not just from military, but also commercial, economic perspective. So the current book came out of the journey of that book, but then when my audience read the book, there was a demand, actually, to understand a lot more about the Indo-Pacific. What are countries like Japan, for example, what are they doing? Why are they suddenly investing so much in space? What is the motivation? Why is ASEAN interested in space suddenly and wanting to have a space agency like ESA, for example, European Space Agency? So the current book, what it does is that I'm starting to write it, and so it's going to look at space power theory. What do the space power theory mean? And then within that, what I'm doing is that I'm doing a comparative case study analysis. So I'm looking at the United States. What is the classical thinking of the United States military doctrine in terms of space? I'm looking at China, India, Russia, Japan, and looking at strategic classical texts from those nations as well. I'm drawing it out in terms of looking at their conception, societal conception of space power, military doctrine, speeches, but also drawing those speeches back to, say, for example, in China's case, Mao's revolutionary warfare, three stages, and how space is being conceptualized by Xi Jinping within that particular tradition. For India, Kautilya, who talks a lot about economic power and why it matters for military power projection, and Indian policymakers are starting to think about space from that perspective. For Japan, Musashi, and the idea of precision, very precision and very much focus on technological advantage, which Japan's starting to do. So yeah, so that's what the book is about. So hopefully I'll finish it by next year.
I suspect you will. Well, a year ago we sat together on a dialogue. We're here this year. I suspect next year we'll be talking about your next book. Thank you for being on Dialogue. This has been an amazing discussion.
Thank you for having me, James. Always a pleasure.
As we conclude today's dialogue, space has become central to modern security. Not merely enabling operations, but shaping outcomes. The ability to secure, protect, and sustain access to the orbital high ground may prove as important in the 21st century as command of the seas was in the centuries past. These conversations shape security. On behalf of all of us at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies, thank you for joining us for this important dialogue. My thanks to Dr. Namrata Goswami for her insights and analysis. I'm James Minnick. Until we meet again, aloha oi. The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.